I think rather.
Thinking it might be such a brilliant thing to do because Vietnam was rather hopeless anyway and put a Republican there. I don't know. That's what I read in the papers. I never really asked him why he sent Lodge there.
I'm sure that entered in. I think Rusk suggested it, and I think the president was attracted to it partly for that reason and partly because Lodge had served as a liaison officer with the French army in the Second World War and spoke excellent French. Partly because he wanted his figure out there to have enough prestige to recapture control of our policy from General Harkins and the military. I think all those things may have entered in. I think Latin America was something the president cared about a great deal, obviously. And you mentioned earlier about his admiration for Betancourt and for Laris Camargo. Did he ever, do you remember Frondizi of Argentina?
No.
He
That was a men's lunch.
That was a men's lunch. Mm-hmm. The Brazilian trip was always about to take place.
Ever... Oh, we always had our bags packed for that trip. And I remember one so interesting thing that he said about Quadros. When Quadros resigned, or what? Did resign, didn't
yes,
he?
Yes, he did.
And Jack shook his head. He was just, he was rather disgusted, and he said, you don't have the right to do that. You know, one doesn't have the right to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't have to run again or something, but you don't have the right once you're in there and the heat gets too strong to just get out of the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think everyone had thought quite a lot of Quadros before,
that's
hadn't
right.
they?
Yep.
And pinned a lot of hopes on him. And, you know, Jack was, well, not horrified, because that's too strong a word, but that just wasn't in his way of doing things. You know, when you took on something, just the way he was always prepared to lose this election, I don't think he would have, but he was talking about it, on civil rights, sometimes when things were bad, and he'd say, well, maybe, you know, but it was something that had to be done. That you could never really be a great president unless you were prepared to be hated or to lose on something that counted. Again, the whole thing of profiles and courage. And that's just what Quadros was the opposite of.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any particular reaction to Goulart?
No. That was that lunch again. I was sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he thought Goulart was sort of a shifty character.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, and, I mean, so, well, there were, I mean, you know, Goulart was really messing everything up, wasn't he, in the economy, and the communist. I think he thought he was a faker and a robber and a, but I don't know what he exactly thought.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any particular, remember anything in particular about Peru?
Yes, you know, Prado of Peru had been here on a state visit. He was really rather a comic character. But anyway, when he was overthrown, it reminds me so now of everyone saying that the United States recognized the junta in Brazil too quickly, because we held off recognition or something.
We suspended relations and stopped aid.
That's right. And later on, Rosita Prado, who Pat went to school with, wrote Jack a letter saying, you saved my father's life, because they were going to execute Prado and I guess his wife. And because of what we did and everything, they let him get out and get to Paris and all of that. But, you know, just making it rough for them for a while there, you know, finally made it better in the long run, instead of just saying, hooray, hooray, they've overthrown. When I get,
they were absolutely right.
That's right, no, yeah.
What we did was we suspended and said we will resume if you agree to do certain things like give parties political freedom, restore freedom of the press, agree to hold elections. They finally agreed to do these things and then we resumed relations. And it made a great difference.
And in Brazil, the minute the junta took over this time, everyone just had cheers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the most disillusioning thing. Betancourt was here talking to me at about 2 months ago. He said all, you know, half of Congress or Parliament, whatever it is, all the great writers, everyone has their civil liberties taken away from them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the most despairing things in Latin America, the difference between Kennedy and Johnson.
Yeah.
It affected all the countries. And Jack never would have done it that way.
Charlie Bartlett played a role in working out the conditions of the new government in Peru. You remember anything about that?
No, I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm. He helped, I think, Charlie and Berkemeyer were a kind of thing on that. The Dominican Republic, was there anything particular there? John Bartlow Martin or Bosch? Not much.
Well, he just said, you know, how insurmountable Bosch's problems were going to be. You know, he hoped so it would work, and then didn't.
What was his general feeling about the Foreign Service?
Oh, and the State Department.
And the State Department.
Well, it was just despair, and he used to talk all the time. You know, he had such high hopes for Rusk in the beginning, when you read his dossier or what the man was. And he liked him, sort of personally. I mean, you can never say Dean Rusk is mean or anything, but he saw him just get to sort of be the tool, really. And he saw that that man was so, could never dare to make a decision. And he never would make a decision. And Jack used to come home some nights and say, God damn it, Bundy and I get more done in one day in the White House than they do in 6 months in the State Department. I remember once they'd asked for some message to be drafted to Russia, a very unimportant one, something like wishing Khrushchev happy birthday, maybe a little more important. And either 6 or 11 weeks went by and nothing had come.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came, this is another very late example, when I came back from Morocco, I told him of this brilliant young, very low man in our embassy there who'd been attached to the Secret Service, who'd learned all the Berber languages and everything, had been there 2 years, and he was going to be transferred to the Caribbean or something, and he wanted so to go to that part of the world, Algeria or something. Well, when I told Jack that, he was really mad, because he said, I wrote Rusk a memo about that 6 months ago, that you shouldn't have this policy of moving everyone every 2 years, you know, that it's so much better to let them build up some knowledge. I mean, and he used to say that sending an order to Rusk of the State Department was like dropping it in the dead letterbox. And the one thing he was thinking of, you asked me once what he was planning to do after the election, he was to get rid of Dean Rusk, but yet he so hated to hurt anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, can he go back to the Rockefeller Foundation? And he said, no, so sadly, you know, he's given all that up, he really burned his bridges. And I think he was sort of toying with the idea of putting McNamara in there, but it really wasn't firmed up, because I don't, you know if he thought exactly McNamara would be right for foreign policy, but really he kind of, and he didn't want to let Bundy go because he needed Bundy with him. But he wanted someone in there, I mean, almost like McNamara, Bobby, who could just flush out all those. And it was so funny, one day, three ambassadors came in to say goodbye to him. And he said they all had on striped shirts with a white collar and cuffs, you know, very English, with umbrellas on their arms. And two of them had on what he called slave bracelets. I don't know if he meant identification bracelets or elephant hair.
These
bracelets.
Are our U.S. ambassadors,
yes.
About to go overseas.
And one was going to Africa and one was going to the Near East, I don't know, Lebanon or Turkey or somewhere. And these sort of precious flits came in his office. And he was just so, you know, it was the wrong idea of the kind of people he wanted to be sent out there anyway. He wanted a more rugged America sent. And he called up Rusk the minute the last one had left his office. I guess there weren't three in a day, but say three over a week. And said, I want you to send out a memo to everyone in the Foreign Service that not one of them can wear a slave bracelet anymore. But, you know, those were the kind of people who took Rusk over in the end.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And he cared so about the little, where was Rusk? He wasn't in on either part of the missile crisis or something terribly important, because he'd have to go to a
Nassau.
Oh, Nassau.
He did not go to Nassau because he had to go to a dinner for the foreign ambassadors, the annual diplomatic dinner for foreign ambassadors in Washington.
Yeah, well, little things like that. I mean, he turned into... I mean, Angie Duke was brained. I mean, Jack said one terrific thing about Angie Duke, who he was so proud of in a way, because Angie does have the most beautiful manners in the world and did so much helping all that way. But Angie wanted to get out of being chief of protocol. And Jack was so surprised where Angie wanted to go. It was Tanganyika. And Jack thought he would have wanted...
Denmark.
Yeah, but he sort of wanted to be a Bill Blair going to eternal parties. He was rather disillusioned to Bill Blair for that, by the way. But, you know, he said, I'm not sure Angie's quite up to Tanganyika, but he was very impressed that he wanted to go where life could be rugged. And, as I said, what about Africans? And Dean Rusk, and another thing about Dean Rusk, you know, Jack was very formal. He never called anyone by the first names until he really knew them well. And Dean Rusk was the one member of his cabinet, probably because he was older and he hadn't known him before, who he called Mr. Rusk right up till the last year. And suddenly, one day they broke down and he called him Dean. But people don't know that he was that. It was part of his English, admiration for things English.
Mm-hmm.
He never liked it if anyone called you Jack or me Jackie, or except in the campaign when they yell it.
Mm-hmm.
Then it's a sign of liking you.
Mm-hmm.
And he never would call anyone. He always called my mother and stepfather Mr. and Mrs. Ortenclaus.
Oh, really?
He called my mother Mummy because he thought it was such a funny name. It's sort of a joke. But he always called my father Mr. Booth.
He never called your mother Janet?
Uh-uh, never.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, you know, he knew them so well.
Yeah.
Just, he didn't think it was right.
Mm-hmm. What about some of the other people in the State Department? George Ball?
Well, I can't exactly remember what, but I can remember he wasn't always entirely pleased with George Ball.
Of course, poor old Chester.
Oh, yeah, Chester. He used to say about Chester Bowles would give some endless talk at a meeting about we should take the mud huts out of enslavement and raise the standard of the blah, you know, go on for these rolling phrases for hours, and then Jack would say, yes, Chester, but I'm not asking you that. I'm asking you what we should do about this problem, X, Y, Z, something rather simple. And Chester would never have an answer.
Mm-hmm.
And so he couldn't wait to get, he couldn't wait to get him out of there.
Avril he liked.
Yes, Avril did like. But, well, Rostow, he used to say, it was funny, one night I was at a seminar at the Dillons. Jack was out of town and in making a speech somewhere, and he called me up and I was called out of the room, and he said, what's the seminar? And I said, it's Walt Rostow talking about underdeveloped countries. And a lot of people like you and Bundy and everyone were there. And he said so loudly, I have to put my hand over the receiver, Jesus Christ, you mean all those people are... Walt Rostow's got all those people trapped in there listening to him? Because he really thought Walt Rostow went on and was hard to listen to.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I'm glad I'm not at that seminar. But he liked him. He never said anything mean about him.
Mm-hmm.
He said Jerome Wiesner always used to peek through his door. He'd come around through Mrs. Lincoln's office. And peek, he said, it used to drive him crazy. Every time the door would be open, Wiesner's head would peek in and out, and it would finally drive him so crazy. He'd say, all right, come in, or else go away, and it was usually something unimportant.
He liked Wiesner, though, I think.
Oh, yes.
On this, when it came to appointing ambassadors, there was always, the State Department always wanted to appoint a foreign service officer. And, White House people always wanted to send some known foreign service officer, someone like Bill Atwood or someone like that. Did he ever comment on that general problem?
Well, just as I said, that the foreign service ambassadors were usually so awful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sometimes you obviously had to send one. You couldn't demoralize the State Department so completely.
Then he went over there to give a talk to them once and to tell them, and he really prepared that talk. And what he wanted to tell them was, he said it's so awful in the State Department. They get so demoralized, and they get sort of trained not to take a position one way or the other, mm-hmm. that by the time they get way up, and he said younger people should get up quicker, you know, they just can't give you any answer but the answer that's no answer, safe on both sides. And so the whole point of the speech that he gave to them was that you must, you know, be prepared to take an answer one way or the other. And something about Congress was in it, too. You must be prepared to go to Congress. Or, I don't know. Just that their training was wrong and they were brainwashed by the time they got there. And, you know, mostly too effete to do any good, which was sort of the standard the people at the State Department admired.
Mm-hmm.
And just to say something rather interesting and unfair about someone who was a friend, which Jack never said to me, but I saw this later, this winter when he came to see me. It's Chip Bolin. He loved Chip Bolin, and when Chip Bolin was around. And sometimes I used to tease Chip Bolin, say that he was too stuffy, a State Department-ish. I used to just see the side in little things. But he was appointed ambassador to Paris just about the time of the missile crisis.
That's right.
And Bobby asked him to stay. And I think Jack asked him, but sort of vaguely. But Chip Bolin couldn't wait to get on that boat. And I think, and I said to him this winter, he came to see me in this house, something about it, or why weren't you there? And, oh, and Bobby told me the reason he wanted Chip Bolin to stay so much was that he'd been their Russian advisor for so long, and Llewellyn Thompson had just sort of come in,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't really know Thompson that well, so here they were entering this crisis with a new Russian expert. But Bolin had to take the boat. He wasn't even going to take a plane. And so I said to Bolin, you know, aren't you sad, or you missed it, or why did you go? And he said, oh, well, I didn't think it was very important. It didn't seem so bad for me. And he thought, I thought I could perhaps do more good over there, you know, from that side, which was so much baloney because he just barely got there. And he said, was it really all that serious? It didn't seem that to me. I thought, my Lord, the greatest, most awful thing that's happened in your lifetime, and all you can say was it not that serious? And the thing is that even Chip Bolin was so imbued, who was a brilliant man, by that State Department thinking that the one thing that mattered to him most, he'd finally been made ambassador to Paris, where he said he hoped and assumed he would stay. He told me this is under Johnson. But once that happened, he didn't care what was happening, he was going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that's sad.
Mm-hmm.
Makes me think, though I love Bolin, it makes me think so much less of him.
I know, it's very puzzling. I did an oral history thing with him, and he went through all this, and I asked him and got the same. And he said, well, everything was set up, and if I went to Paris, I could explain what our policy was, and it was not convincing.
And
yeah, he loved the president, and said one marvelous thing about him. He said, it's on the tape, that he said if when the president was killed and Johnson came in, I felt this was the future giving way to the present or the past.
Oh, yeah. I know he had, then another thing that disappointed me about him, he was there at the ceremonies where they named a street after Jack mm-hmm. in Paris, and he sent me his speech. Well, one line of it was, though there was a certain sadness about this day, the naming of this street shows that Franco-American relations is a great step forward for Franco-American relations or something. Well, I just thought, this day, une certaine tristesse was the words. I wanted to write him back. But the poor man sent me the speech, so of course he was trying to do his best and say, is that all you think of this day, a certain sadness? You sound like Hervé with your Franco-American relations. So Bolin had so much, but he doesn't, I don't know, a little extra thing.
Mm-hmm. He's the best of the Foreign Service officers, but yeah. Even he has been deformed
in
some way by that.
And for instance, if he, who's brilliant, could have been made Secretary of State, it wouldn't have done any good because he would protect his own. And that was just what Jack wanted to get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
People who would protect their own.
Mm-hmm. On the domestic side, economic policy and so on, Walter Heller.
I don't really know what he thought about what Walter Heller did or everything. He wasn't, you know, he didn't have the same personality as Walter Heller. So whereas Galbraith and everyone you would have home or for dinner, we never saw Walter Heller. I think he thought he leaked a lot of things, didn't he? Or that he was talking to the press or something.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, I never heard him say anything against Walter Heller.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought Walter Heller was sort of a... Well, a jerk when you meet him. I never could believe he was such a brilliant economist.
He did a good job, I think.
But
and has been very unhappy since.
So, I never heard him... But, I mean, we didn't... Jack and I didn't really talk economics, so... I guess he thought he was fine.
Mm-hmm. On the Supreme Court, you... The president...
He'd left Douglas Dillon.
Yeah.
But, and he thought a lot of Dave Bell.
Mm-hmm. Because he relied heavily on Dave Bell. When Kermit Gordon became director of the budget, was there any particular reaction?
Well, that's because he wanted what, Dave Bell?
Dave went over to AID.
Yeah.
But Gordon didn't.
I don't know anything about that. Mm-hmm. But wasn't he sad that Dave Bell had to leave being director of the budget? Yeah, he was really sad about that.
But he felt Dave was the only man who could straighten out the AID situation. Remember Fowler Hamilton?
Right. And he was very sad the way it came out about Fowler Hamilton. I can't remember exactly, but it looked as if he... LaBouise. It looked as if he'd been fired for incompetency or something, and Jack so badly wanted to have it come that he was being promoted by being ambassador to Greece. However that story came out, he was sorry for LaBouise.
Mm-hmm.
He was sad.
Mm-hmm.
Shows a certain charity again.
The president made two appointments to the Supreme Court. You remember Byron White and Arthur Goldberg. Did he talk much about the court or about...
Well, I remember he was really happy that he'd have two appointments to make.
Mm-hmm.
And he thought, he thought both his appointments were good.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I know that Justice Frankfurter, he knew, wanted him to appoint whoever it was.
Paul Freund.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And he knew of that wish. He went to call in Frankfurter a couple of times and again once brought him to his office.
Mm-hmm.
But he wanted to put Goldberg in there.
Mm-hmm. He and Bill Douglas used to be... At least Bill Douglas was a great friend of Mr. Kennedy.
Of his father's, and then Bill, really of Bobby's. They were always going off all through Russia and everything together. We never really saw Bill Douglas much, but I think he liked him.
Mm-hmm. But he wasn't around the White House much.
No, never.
Never.
But none of those people were. Arthur Goldberg used to be around our house in Georgetown a lot for the time of the labor bill, but that was always for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
And Arthur Goldberg, I said to Jack once, some dinner where I sat next to him, he is the biggest egomaniac of any man I've ever seen in my life. And it's true, I've never seen a man who never stops talking about himself.
Yeah. He does it with sort of an innocent, joyous way, but it is horrible.
Well, I find that horrifying. I'm not sure Jack didn't make a mistake putting him in the Supreme Court, because that just seems to make people think they're more and more special.
And as they're out of the newspapers, they feel they have to make up for that.
And the decision that I thought this winter, you know, that was made after Jack's death, this case where it's all right to print anything, even libel, about someone in the press.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little more complicated than that. But you remember
the New York
decision?
Times case, wasn't it?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But that seems such an awful thing to do. And Goldberg was the one who held out and said that it could even be malicious and completely untrue. And I thought, that's right after that ad of the day in Dallas of the picture of Jack wanted for treason, and the you, his appointee, go and say that everything, even this, is all right. But it's because the Supreme Court is so isolated, they're never affected by newspapers, anything, so Arthur Goldberg's head's going to be even more swelled in a few more years. So I guess Jack always said he was the most brilliant labor lawyer that ever was.
What about the president and the press, apart from Charlie Bartlett and Ben Bradley, who were...
I suppose so many of our friends before the White House were in the press. I mean, there's Rolly Evans, Hugh Seide, Bill Lawrence, he played golf with. You know, he basically liked them. I always thought in Washington, politics and the press, you're both sort of involved in doing something. I mean, so many of his friends were there. Bill Kent in Florida would be around sometimes. He liked the kind of badinage and everything you could have with them. His friends were there much more than his colleagues in Congress. But we had some there. And then people always used to say that he was so thin-skinned by the press, but that really wasn't true. And it was so funny, because one night Ben Bradley was taunting him. Or, no, he was saying to Ben Bradley something that was written was untrue. And Ben Bradley came one night for dinner in an absolute rage because some tiny little Republican newsletter that his John Birch mother-in-law subscribed to had a paragraph written by, not Tony Lewis, but Tony someone who wrote for Nixon.
Ralph DiToledano
had written something bad about Ben Bradley. You would have thought it was, but... been over the front page of the New York Times, just one or two sentences, and Ben was in a rage. And Jack just sort of he didn't really rub it in, he just leaned back and looked amused and said, "We'll see how you fellows feel when something unfair is written." But he never, I guess the one thing he admitted was a mistake, was canceling the Herald Tribune. But he didn't, he was a little bit more that way in the beginning, but at the end, he'd never mention unfavorable things, or if I'd say, "Oh, I think so and so, so awful," when I come home tonight, he'd say, "Don't think about it, don't read those things." And he just accepted it as part of the, and, you know, when there was something good, I mean, he wouldn't mention it. I'd say, "Wasn't it wonderful what, I don't know, someone said today," if I could find it.
What about the great statesmen of the press, like Lippmann and Scotty and all the rest, and Joe also?
Well, Joe was his friend. And I think with Lippmann and Reston, I think he thought Reston was awfully sanctimonious and sort of... So they were never close. I mean, I'm sure Jack saw them in his office and things. And of course they had this, which comes out much more later and you hear about it, kind of jealousy or resentment of Jack, because the first time there was a president who probably was brighter than they were, who was younger, who was either... Lippmann had two things against Jack, partly his father and partly being Catholic, strangely enough. You know, you hear this in conversations with other people, but he could never sort of purge from his...
Yeah, and I think Lippmann's wife was an ex-Catholic. He was brought up and went to a convent and broke with it, and I think that had some...
Well, I remember...
Though remember in 1960 that Lippmann wrote marvelous columns.
Yeah. I can't really remember what they wrote and what they didn't sometimes, but, you know, his contact... And he wouldn't sort of be a sycophant to them. I mean, he wouldn't suck around, but, you know, he just... In the press, he really saw the people who were he liked. Someone funny like Bill Lawrence. Just, you know.
But you don't feel that he was unduly sensitive to the press. One thing that a lot of people have written about the administration is that no administration is more interested in its own image, to use that odious word, and so on.
Well, that to me, it's like reading about someone... you know, it's so untrue. And then they'd all talk about the public relations setup that we had going before the, during, you know, before the campaign and the this and the that, and our image. Well, Jack never thought of his image, and there was never anyone public relations except, you know, Charlie Bartlett always used to say, you're doing too many articles.
Mm-hmm.
But he used to say to Charlie, you know, I have so many much against me, the only one in a certain position, that mightn't be the best way to get what I'm aiming for, the nomination. But this way it is,
mm-hmm.
you know, to just get more and more known and bombard them. So his only public relations things was that when they asked for interviews and the, he would do them. But he never had anyone advising there, and he never thought about our image. In fact, our image, when you think of something so incredible about me, I was always a liability to him until we got to the White House. And he never asked me to change or said anything about it. Everyone thought I was a snob from Newport who had bouffant hair and had French clothes and hated politics. And then because I was often having these babies, I wasn't able to campaign, you know, be around with them as much as I could have. And he'd get so upset for me when something like that came out. And I'd say, oh, Jack, I wish, you know, I'm so sorry for you that I'm just such a dud. And he knew it wasn't true, and he didn't want me to change. I mean, he knew I loved him, and I did everything I could, and when I did campaign with him, I did it very hard, and I spoke French all through Massachusetts to counteract Henry Cabot Lodge until people came up and used to be surprised that I could speak English. I mean, he was, you know, proud. So he never asked me, you know, there I was the worst liability.
Mm-hmm.
And there Lee, Princess Radziville and everything. And I was so happy, I remember thinking, once you got in the White House, it's really true of any president's wife. Everything that was bad is suddenly new.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's interesting. So whereas then that you have decent French food is a plus instead of a minus that you don't like, you know, stay in the kitchen all day making Irish stew. And when I did the tour of the White House, well, he was so proud of that. He used to show that and ask people about it. And then that I did the guidebook over everybody's objections. They all said in the West Wing that it would be awful to have money change hands in the White House. But then he was proud of me, and I was so happy that at last I'd been able to be something that he could be proud of. But, I mean, that shows he wasn't thinking of his image, or he would have made me get a little frizzy permanent and be like Pat Nixon, and, you know, and Pat and Dick, and he never would hold hands in public or put his arm around me, or, you know, because that was naturally just distasteful to him, as I think it is for any man.
Mm-hmm.
So he didn't do anything for his image. And, he used to tell me, sometimes he'd tell me I should wear hats instead of then there were all these letters about my skirt's too short. And he said, but they're not too short. And he said, oh, I guess you're right. But, you know, he never said lengthen them.
Mm-hmm. He never tried to ask you to do, not just to stop being yourself for any political or public relations purpose.
And I think he liked that I was, I mean, he knew I was being myself and that I did like to stay in the background. I think he appreciated that in a wife.
Mm-hmm.
And he married me really for the things I was.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, and then when they didn't work out politically, he was never, he can ask me to change, which I just think was so nice about him, because he wouldn't be fake in any way. And he wouldn't be fake about his children or, you know, and he wouldn't kiss babies and...
Mm-hmm.
So all that was really written by people who just didn't understand him. The one thing he was, which people can't understand, and which was at where I felt so sorry for poor Nixon, who had such a disadvantage, Jack was the most unselfconscious person I've ever seen. He just naturally could be attractive in a crowd or a room. He was unselfconscious about walking around with a towel on if it fell off or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he'd put it on again, but... Well, so many people are worried and nervous in public appearances. Nixon was, and, you know, he would sweat and everything. So the people who weren't sort of sure of themselves, who had that wonderful ease of Jack, was, in a way, jealous. And you know, attributed all these funny things to him.
Mm-hmm.
Which weren't true. He was just always a natural.
How do you feel about the White House staff?
Who do you mean by that?
Well, we're talking about the public thing, Pierre. And,
I think he loved them all.
Mm.
I think Pierre, I used to get so mad at Pierre because he did have a certain hamming up thing that really didn't help protect my children much. I mean, he'd give a long interview about some drunken rabbit. And I'd blow up at Pierre, but then I'd say to Jack, there's the nicest thing about Pierre. You can really say the most terrible things to him, which I did sometimes. And he never bore a grudge, and it would be over like that. So Jack was grateful to Pierre for that. And when I look at it now, without Jack, you see that his White House staff is the most extraordinary collection of people who were so different, who now a lot of them dislike each other. And maybe they did then, but you never knew it then. But I mean, there were the Irish Mafia, there was Pierre. There was Mrs. Lincoln, who was jealous of anyone who came near Jack. There were the professors, you know, there was you, there was Bundy. Ralph Dungan, Mike Feldman, and all adoring Jack and knowing that, and then there was me and our private life and friends. All kept together because they knew he thought highly of each of them and that their contribution was to their utmost. And he loved all of them, and they all loved him. And Jack held this motley band, who now, from some of them, at least from the Irish, are just so bitter about everyone else in there. But you never saw that.
I thought it was the most exceptionally harmonious experience. And, you know, everyone warned me before joining it that there'd be feuds and knives out and so on. I just thought it was the best possible experience of dealing with the people around the president because of the way he you know, managed everybody.
Yeah. And I often thought it was, not exactly, but you know, you hear it said that mother love is infinite, and it isn't that you can love two children, and then if you have nine, that means you love them just that much less. Well, there weren't really any jealousies or favorites. No one ever thought Jack had a favorite.
That's right.
Unless it was Dave Powers, who was a favorite for what everyone hoped he would have a favorite for, someone to relax in.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't have any favorites. And so that way they could all work together so fantastic. There was no intrigue of who's in and who's out. And as Kenny said, you know, that he didn't put Kenny in the position of being the only man you could get to see the president through. They could also sneak around through Mrs. Lincoln's door, or Tish would manage to, you know, there were so many ways.
Yeah.
He was so accessible, and yet he got so much more done than now.
Mm-hmm.
He was accessible, but when he worked, he really worked. He didn't, you know, break things up.
When would the president see the children?
He'd see the children, I didn't tell you all our day once, did I? Of how in the morning George Thomas would rap on her bedroom door about 7:45. Then he would go into his room and the children would come in.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd either turn on the television going absolutely full blast, and he'd have his breakfast sitting in a chair in a tray doing all his, reading the morning papers, going through all his briefing books, or, you know, those sheets of typewritten, his agenda for the day.
He'd do that before he got dressed?
Yeah, he'd, he'd sort of have
dressing gown on or something.
No, he'd take a bath first, and they'd come in while he had a bath. Mm-hmm. I'd tell you all John's toys were by the side of his tub.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd sort of have breakfast in his shirt and underpants.
Mm-hmm.
And on the television, gosh, sometimes it was loud, because I'd often come in, because, you know, sometimes I'd like to just sort of stay in bed till about 9, but I'd come in there and sit with him sometimes. But there'd be cartoons, or there was this awful exercise man, Jack
LaLanne.
At sunrise, Jack would lower it, and there'd be Jack LaLanne, and he'd be telling Caroline and John to do what they were doing, so they'd be lying on the floor. Sometimes he'd touch his toes with John a bit, but he'd have them tumbling around. He loved those children tumbling around him in this sort of sensual is the only way I can think of it. Mm-hmm. And then he'd always come out in the garden during their recess in the morning and clap his hands, and all the little things from school would come running. The teacher, he used to call out his two favorites, Caroline and Mary Warner, and then the teacher said it wasn't fair for him to give them candy. She told Caroline she could only get candy if there would be some for the entire class. So Mrs. Lincoln had an entire box of Baraccini candy. But you know, he'd go out, or if I was around there with John, he'd call us in and a little bit in his office, and then he'd send them out, and then John would play in Mrs. Lincoln's typewriter. Then they'd come over in the evening, just as he was finishing up for the day, and just play around his office. One of the last days I remember, you know, there's that wonderful picture of them all talking about Berlin and Jack, which was an awful sort of a crisis. And John tumbling out from under his desk. But, and then one of the last days that Charlie the dog came in and bit John on the nose, and Bundy had to get Dr. Berkeley. You know, the children were never bratty, but he liked to have them underfoot, and then he'd take them swimming. And, or else it didn't work out quite that way when he'd come upstairs before dinner, no matter who we had for dinner. They'd come in, you know, they'd have their time with them in their pajamas, and he really would play with them first, even if it was a state dinner. He'd always say, or even when it was a state lunch or just a man's lunch, usually he'd have me in the room and he'd say, go get the children. And of course, they'd always be in their naps and their underwear or something, and I'd have to bring them out in their underwear, because he'd never give you warning before. But he just loved to have them around. And then he'd... he really taught Caroline to swim. He made her dive off the high diving board. He made her swim the length of the pool in Florida the last Christmas she was there, where she got a quarter of the way and did the rest underwater. He was saying, come on, you can make it. You know, he did so much with them. And he told her all these stories. He'd make up the white shark and the black shark and Bobo the Lobo and Maybelle, some little girl who hid in the woods. And then one day he was desperate. And I said, gosh, you got to get me some books or something. I'm running out of children's stories. He said, I just told Caroline how she and I shot down three Jap fighter planes. But,
were there any books that he liked reading, or the children demanded that he read?
No, he didn't read. He didn't like to read books to them much. He'd rather tell them stories. Mm-hmm. But he make up these fantastic ones.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of... they were just riveted by. Oh, and then he had ponies for Caroline, White Star and Black Star. And then Caroline said to me, Daddy would always let me choose which pony I wanted to ride and which pony my friend would ride. And then he would make some race. And he'd always let Caroline win the race. And then he had Miss Shaw was in a lot of them rather ludicrously.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Throttlebottom was in the race, and how Caroline went hunting the Orange County hounds, and then White Star and Black Star. Oh, she went in the Grand National and beat every, you know, little things that had to do with their world where they did absolutely extraordinarily. John got his PT boat and shot a Jap destroyer or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But and never got impatient. They come in his bed, you know.
When you went to Hyannisport or Newport or Palm Beach, where he'd have more time with the children, was, of course, he couldn't lift them or play with them himself, could he, with the back?
Well, he really, if he was on the floor, he'd get on the floor, then he could really roll around with them.
Mm-hmm.
And he could lift Caroline up, and he used to throw around an awful lot before we got to the White House. But... they'd be in our room in the morning, and then he'd swim with them about an hour, and then he always wanted them to come out in the boat with us. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, you know, they really were quite young, they'd get awfully cranky if they missed their nap, but he always wanted them to come. So you'd put them to bed inside for half an hour or something. Maybe they would get whiny, but he always wanted them there. Or at Camp David and things, you'd sort of sit out and have supper with him. We'd run on the lawn and everything.
What place relaxed him most, do you think, when he, of the various places you went?
It was really the boat that relaxed him the most. Mm-hmm. Before he was president, it was to go out in his father's boat, the Marlin.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Honey Fitz. And the reason for that was there was no telephone. He was awful about the phone. It could never ring, but he wouldn't answer it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, calls would come or else he'd be getting 10 people on the phone. So there, I mean, rain or shine. I can remember him taking Adlai Stevenson out in the Honey Fitz one day in November. Late October in Newport, hurricane season. I got 2 polo coats for Adlai and a pith helmet of my stepfather's, and Jack was sitting in the back in a black sweater, the hair, wind blowing his hair, blissfully happy with fish chowder, and I was inside with 2 blankets on, drinking hot soup.
Mm-hmm.
That's how cold it was.
Mm-hmm.
He just thought, you know, everyone would love that boat because that was his away from care. It was for what, getting out on a horse was for me, in the air, no phone.
Mm-hmm.
Not that mad about riding or horses or hunting.
Mm-hmm.
But the release from tension in the air.
Mm-hmm.
He loved the sun and the water and no phone.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, friends there. You always had friends there that he never used the boat for working.
Mm-hmm.
But whoever you want to relax with.
What did he think of all these skits about him? Like the first family and so on. Did you ever listen to them?
I think he listened. I'm not sure he listened to all of that record. I listened to one side and then I threw it away because I didn't want my children to see it.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, he wasn't. I guess he sort of took it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I thought it was so unfair, but he didn't. I guess he just accepted it. I mean, he obviously didn't like it, but he didn't. No, I was the one who got much more worked up about those things. I mean, I thought it was so mean. I didn't care if they made fun of me or anything. But when they made fun of little children, and the first year he was president, I went to the women's press club dinner. He had a fever that night, and so Lyndon took me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tradition for the president and his wife to go, and a woman named Bonnie Angelo came out on a tricycle as Caroline and sang some awful song. And the next year I wouldn't go, and that Bonnie Angelo was president. Pierre really got upset by that, and I said, I'm not going to go, and you can either tell them why, Pierre, for what they did last year, or you can make up any excuse you think is best. And when I explained that to Jack, I just felt so strongly about those children. It was hard enough protecting them in the Kennedy family, where some of the cousins, especially Eunice's children, were so conscious of the position, would always wear Kennedy buttons and would play that record, My Daddy is President, What Does Your Daddy Do? Or the First Family, and I hid all those things from my children and always taught them that the White House was sort of temporary. I'm so glad I did for the way it ended, but that it was while Daddy was president and presidents had lived in it before. I'd tell them when Franklin Roosevelt would come to dinner or Mrs. Longworth, or President Truman. I'd tell them little stories about other presidents, and then there would be a president after Daddy, and then we would be living in Hyannis. And, you know, so they never got to think of all this was going to be forever in this power, which the others were awful about. So I'd get upset about the skits, but he didn't like to see me get upset, but I guess he knew it was part of being president. And because it was such a different and young and family, there was so much more to make skits about with us, which he said sort of wryly to me once.
The president often talked much about the things he would like to do. You mentioned a new Secretary of State.
I know he was going to get rid of J. Edgar Hoover the minute.
Mm-hmm.
And he always said that those were the 2 things he did first, you know, Hoover and Allen Dulles.
Yes.
Which I guess he had to do at the time. He couldn't have not.
Did he have any ever talk about who, what he would do with the FBI?
No, he didn't say who he'd make. But, and then Bobby was going to leave the Justice Department. I think he might have made Nick Katzenbach the head. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
And, well, I know there was going to be a domestic peace corps, but I guess that was sort of started, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I know he was going to do this poverty thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know he really cared about Kentucky was the place he spoke to me about. And we were going to go to Kentucky sometime. I mean, I know it was mentioned.
Yeah, Appalachia.
That's it, Appalachia. And he was going to Russia.
Yes, I wanted to ask you about that.
Sometime in the second term, we were going to go to Russia, and that, you know, that would have just been so incredible. Mm-hmm. We were going to go to the Far East. I guess I always thought he was going to go in December, but then as he wasn't talking about it, I guess, with Indonesia and everything, it was sort of...
But I think he was planning to go in the spring to the Far East.
And it would have been so incredible for him to go to Japan when you think Eisenhower couldn't go there, and you know, the crowds and everything he would have gotten. That's what, if all this had to happen, I just wish he could have seen some more good things come in that he worked so hard for. The tax bill, the civil rights bill, the economy up so high. You know, think of all those businessmen who still say awful things about him, and suddenly the gold flow is absolutely stopped. The gross national product's never been so high. But to go to Japan and to go to Russia, if he could have just seen all those and then this happened, and won, if he could have just won, and he was so praying it would be Goldwater that he'd have to run against. He used to say, let Barry alone, he's doing just fine. You know,
mm-hmm.
He could have just seen some of the good things.
He would have liked to run against Goldwater. Did he think Goldwater was going to get it? Or
it was just too much to hope for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was just too good to be true. I don't think he did.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning, quite a while ago, he thought Romney would, and he was nervous about Romney, because he said he'd be sort of hard. But then I think later on, he didn't think Romney would so mm-hmm. much. I don't know who he thought would.
You ever talk about Rockefeller?
Yeah. He said Rockefeller, in a way, was sort of a coward because he should have done what Jack did and run in those primaries, but either he was had cold feet or was nervous about, you know, not going into New Hampshire and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And he said if he had, he would have been president.
Mm-hmm. You know. Well, the president did feel that if Rockefeller had gotten the nomination in 1960, he would have been elected. Mm-hmm.
Well,
I think that's right.
And he said, you know, he just didn't have the, I don't know whether it was gumption or judgment or just timid soul or something.
Mm-hmm.
And of course now the poor man's doing it all with completely the wrong sense of timing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he thought very much of Rockefeller, but he didn't really say anything mean against him.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't like Nixon, and he really thought he was dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that he was a little bit...
thought he was sick.
Sick, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Scranton?
Well, I don't remember talking with him about Scranton. You know, he was sort of coming up, and I suppose he thought he might have had it, but I never can remember talking to him.
Did he look forward to the 64 campaign?
Oh, yes. You know, and I look forward to it so much. It was when you could do together. Campaigning so different when you're president. It wouldn't be those awful things of plodding through Wisconsin, forcing somebody to shake hands with you. You know, when he really looked forward to it, and then to winning, and then to just sort of solidifying. You know, he really did so much, there wasn't that much more to do, except it would have gelled,
mm-hmm.
and it would have been relations with other countries. I mean, it would have been Latin America and with Russia. And, you know, and de Gaulle never would have recognized Red China and all of that if he'd stayed alive.
You ever talk with regard to the Russian trip about anything particularly you wanted to see or do?
No, just that they would be the most fantastic crowd.
Was it just Moscow or?
It was just a Russian trip.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he never really went into it. And what did he say? When things got nicer about Khrushchev, you know, after the detente and everything, he always used to say, well, Remember what he said after Vienna, that he really is a gangster.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody mustn't get deluded, you know, but you deal with him out of firmness. It's different, but he never wanted to get people to think that now Khrushchev was this sweet, benign, undangerous person.
Mm-hmm. Did he ever talk about his letters, his correspondence with Khrushchev?
Well, just that there was one.
Mm-hmm.
But he never told me what... I didn't ask him what was in them. Mm-hmm. If I'd asked, I could have seen them, because every time I'd ask about something like that, he'd say, get Bundy to show you.
Mm-hmm.
Bundy did, and for a couple of months there, Bundy was sending me all the intelligence top briefings and everything, and then finally I got so bored, discouraged reading them. I said, please never send me another. And when I'd read those things, which Jack had to flip through every day, I didn't see how he could be so cheerful at night or have a drink or go out in honey fits. He'd just read, you know, 20 pages of problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought, well, I better not read them anymore because I can just read the good things and be in a good mood for him. And I remember we gave a little dinner farewell for Ros Gilpatrick. And Mrs. Gilpatrick was saying to Jack all through it was the TFX time. You know, I say to Ros when he comes home every night, how can they say those things about you? Aren't they all awful? And he said to her, my God, you don't say that to your husband when he comes home at night, do you? You know, that's not what you should do. You should say, find one good thing they say. You say, isn't that great? Or bring up something else that will make him happy. And so that's how I sense what he wanted me to be. And that's one reason I stopped reading all those briefings and things, because I didn't want to have to worry about anything. I wanted to sort of take your cue from him. And
well, one of the greatest gifts was his capacity to switch from one thing to another and not be nagged at by problems, to put them aside knowing that he can't do anything more at that moment about them and not let them worry him.
And did I ever tell you about him making me move my desk?
No.
Well, I used to have my desk in the West Sitting Hall where we always sat, and it would be piled high, and especially when Tish was always sending in those damn folders. Just when you'd be sitting happily with Jack, some other messenger would come running in. I think, and he said, move your desk out. I knew I did tell you
this. You
told us. Down to the treaty room. Well, and I couldn't get problems off. But he could always go to sleep, too, which I thought was so important. He didn't have this, you know, he could just turn it off. And I always thought one thing, and I think it's true of Lyndon Johnson, and I think it might have been true of Adlai Stevenson. These things get on you when there's indecision or something, and you can't sleep. You really become, I always thought any president would become an insomniac. But Jack had this built-in thing that Ted Reardon told me about before. Like soldiers in a foxhole. Mm-hmm. It was time to go to sleep, he just could.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of his greatest. It was fortunate he had that. That's about all.
John, this is Chrissy. Want to say hello to Chrissy?
Hi, Chrissy.
It's my little girl.
Take care.
John, what did you do today?
I don't know.
You been playing? Caroline with you?
No.
Which cousin do you like best?
Him.
Tell about West Point.
No, I want to turn the sound on now.
Why?
Because.
What kind of place do you go to West Point?
Olivia Beachy 7. I don't know it. What's that leg on for?
I'll show you now.
Well, when the coop's gonna come.
My lunch was predicted Wednesday. And we talked about Bobby and came up with, I think, an awfully good idea that it could be worth for something for him to do. But just...
What happened to the kitchen there, Sally?
I think Adlai Stevenson ought to be induced to run for Senate in New York, which I think he might. I think he could be persuaded to do. Bobby ought to be made. If he were there, he'd be first place. He'd be out of Washington, in New York, be able to start have an independent base here. Second place, he'd be dealing with the questions which issue interest him most, questions of foreign policy.
Hello. Testing.
We hope you have enjoyed our presentation of Jacqueline Kennedy, Historic Conversations on Life with John F. Kennedy, introduced by Caroline Kennedy and Michael Beschloss, and featuring conversations between Jacqueline Kennedy and Arthur M. Schlesinger, Jr. Digital restoration by Marcos Suedo Ball. Post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. Executive Producer, Karen Jakonski. Copyright 2011 by Caroline Kennedy, John Schlossberg, Rose Schlossberg, and Tatiana Schlossberg. Production copyright 2011 by Caroline Kennedy, John Schlossberg, Rose Schlossberg, and Tatiana Schlossberg. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.